Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
What's the difference between thought and experience?
This entire notion of oneself, what we are, is just this logical structure, a place to momentarily house all the abstractions.
I see through my conscious experience to the world. Can I see my conscious experience itself? How do I make the experience itself into the object of my consciousness?
If this is your first time hearing this, you are about to experience something so cold.
Do we have to experience experience to know about experience?
There's the moment, and then there's the awareness of trying to have the moment. And it's all these layers.
Our guest is Sean Gallagher, author of How the Body Shapes the Mind.
The Phenomenology of Lived Experience, coming up on Philosophy Talk. What's it like to be an innocent civilian trapped in a war zone? Or maybe to have a voice like Luciano Pavarotti, or to view Earth from outer space? Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. I'm here at the studios of KLW San Francisco. I'm alone today because my colleague and co-host John Perry is under the weather and away. And today, we're talking about the phenomenology of lived experience. I want to focus first on the lived experience part to get you an idea of what I'm talking about, and then briefly the phenomenology part. Lived experience. Think about the difference between reading a book about a war zone and actually being in one and experiencing that yourself. No matter how well written the book, reading the book can't possibly replicate the experience of being one. Now, the point I'm trying to make is that there are some things that only lived experience itself can possibly teach us. Nothing, not the testimony of others, not verbal or written instruction, not abstract philosophical thought, which I love, not even a rich imagination, can fully substitute for lived experience. Now, lived experience is what phenomenology is all about. It's about what it and it alone can teach us, both about the world, because experience reveals or discloses the world to us, and about consciousness itself. I want to get you to see what I mean. Think about this. Look at a cup, right? There are two things. There's the cup that you're looking at, and then there's your experience of looking at the cup. Now, the cup is something out there in the world. The cup is not something in your mind. The experience is yours, and in some sense, yours alone. I mean, you and I can look at the same cup. I'm looking at the cup, you're looking at the cup. I'm looking at it from one angle, you're looking at it from another angle. Maybe I'm looking at it from above, you're looking at it from below. We have different experiences of the same cup. But phenomenology cares about the cup ultimately, but it really wants to bring, mostly, I'm not looking at my experience of the cup, I'm having an experience of the cup, looking through the experience to the cup. That's a metaphor, looking through the experience to the cup. But that, I do something like that. So here's a question. How can I bring the experience itself, not just the cup, but my experience of the cup to the fore of my awareness? And why would I want to do that? Because I want to study consciousness. I want to make consciousness itself, not just the study of the world. I want to present consciousness itself to consciousness. Now, that's a lot to swallow. And my guests are going to help us sort through all that. We're going to talk about bracketing the world and all that stuff. But to give you a feel for this topic, it might be more familiar to you through what's called mindfulness studies. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, out to study mindfulness and its relationship to phenomenology. She files this report.
Phenomenologists and practitioners of mindfulness have this idea in common. Our experience of the world out there is mediated by having a body. And not just any old human body, but a particular body with a past, conditioned by everything that's ever happened to it. In a way, our bodies remember the most important moments and all the things that happen when we weren't paying attention. They also remember the things we try to forget. I'm going to tell a story about a guy I'll call Mr. H to protect his privacy. Mr. H had waited 5 months and driven 4 hours to an appointment with a chronic pain specialist. When he got there and the receptionist told him there was no record of his appointment, he threatened to bomb the clinic. Just a few moments later, talking to a psychotherapist, Dr. Lynn Waldy, he could only remember fragments of what had just happened. The blackout was a symptom of severe PTSD, Waldy figured out. But the weird thing was that Mr. H's trauma, it had taken place decades ago. He'd been symptom-free for 20 years. Until now. And the episode at the clinic wasn't the only one. A few months earlier, he'd had his first flashback to his time in Vietnam. It was during a combat scene in a movie. When Mr. H came to on the floor of the theater, he was yelling for everyone to get down. Turns out, these episodes began occurring right after Mr. H had developed a chronic neck pain condition. Waldy determined that
because he was an older adult and was experiencing this chronic pain, those pain sensations in his body themselves were a trauma trigger for him and actually were enough of a trigger to be responsible for an onset of PTSD from an event that had, a set of events that had happened decades earlier.
Mr. H had managed to avoid thinking about his trauma for an extraordinarily long time, but he couldn't avoid his body. Waldy says avoidance is often what keeps people from recovering from trauma.
You know, they may avoid it cognitively by not thinking about it. And sometimes people avoid things very deliberately. They may choose not to go places or talk to people who remind them.
But that means it's hard to immediately recognize the memory that the feeling is associated with. It just feels like a feeling happening now.
Because people avoid fully thinking about and working through the things that have happened to them in the past, that they haven't in some way put the past in the past.
What extreme PTSD cases like this make clear to researchers is that we have many different kinds of memories. You remember where you parked your car, you remember the exact words someone used to break your heart. And then there's the memories you don't even know you have. The smell of someone you haven't seen in a long time, what it feels like to squint at the particular glare of a foggy San Francisco morning, the panic you felt when you thought your parents forgot to pick you up from school and you'd never see them again. And all of that is influencing how we react to the world, whether we realize it or not. This is where mindfulness comes in.
When a person is moving through the world in a mindful way, they'll notice when certain sensations and reactions come up, and then they can evaluate them. They can say, is that something I want to go with, right? Or can I realize and appreciate that I'm having a reaction right now, and it has something to do, not with the current situation, but with something in my past. And so I won't let that influence the way I act or react right now. I'll just say, oh yeah, there I go again.
This person is wearing the same kind of glasses my old boss wore, so now I'm feeling uptight and bitter, for example. But it has no bearing on what's actually happening to me in the present. There are bombs in this movie, but I'm safe in the theater.
That's the sense in which I think people say that to be mindful is to see the world more like it really is.
Because only once you've bracketed the world can you distinguish between it and everything happening inside you, warping your perception. And whether or not perception can ever not be warped, that's a question for phenomenology. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Beal.
Thanks so much, Liza, for that mindful recitation of mindfulness. I'm Ken Taylor. My colleague, John Perry's away today. But today, we're asking about phenomenology and lived experience. I'm joined now by Sean Gallagher. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Memphis. He's author of How the Body Shapes the Mind, and also a very good introduction to phenomenology called Phenomenology. Sean, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much, Ken. It's good to be here.
So, Sean, tell me, just as a human being, from your lived experience, what got you I'm a hardcore analytic philosopher. You love the phenomenological approach. What first attracted you to the phenomenological approach?
Yeah, well, I think it was while I was an undergraduate reading philosophy. I used to read as much as I could because I fell in love with philosophy. And you know how that is.
I do.
Well, I was reading the existentialists, and I got very excited by them. And I remember reading a little story about Jean-Paul Sartre sitting in a cafe and saying, with phenomenology, you can do philosophy that allows you to talk about the cafe and about the wine glass. Your example of the cup in the beginning of the show was a really nice example of that. Yeah. And so what I was interested in was, where did the existentialists come from? What kind of philosophy influenced them? And that's when I sort of found phenomenology, because they were very much influenced by that movement.
Well, that's cool. That's really cool. I mean, my roots in philosophy have different origins, but I appreciate what you're saying. Now, in my brief opening monologue there, usually a dialogue with John, but I said, tell me if I got this roughly right, that the phenomenology is at its core a technique for bringing pure consciousness. Well, I don't know if pure is the right word, but bringing consciousness into focus. I mean, instead of focusing on the cup, I somehow focus on my seeing of the cup, my experiencing of the cup. Is that right? And secondly, how do I do that?
Yeah. Okay. So I think that's partially right. So in one sense, I don't think there's anything like pure consciousness.
Yeah.
This consciousness is always directed towards the world. There's always a reference to something out there. And so our experience always has something of the world in it. And the idea is that phenomenology studies not just consciousness, although it's very much interested in consciousness and the structure of consciousness, how consciousness gives us access to the world, but also it's interested in how the world appears in consciousness, how the world comes into our experience. And so we can talk about wine glasses and cafes and other things out in the world and the kind of feeling I might have towards those things. So the lived experience, as you mentioned before.
So let me, okay, but Husserl, okay, I'm no scholar of these things, John, so you're going to have to help me out. Husserl, I understand, had this idea that you study consciousness. He believed, as you said, that consciousness is always consciousness of something, right? But you can study the consciousness and not just what it's of. I mean, but of course, it's consciousness. Consciousness is always consciousness of something. But you can study the consciousness by bracketing the world. What exactly did he mean by that? How do I bracket the world?
Yeah. So it's actually not so much bracketing the world. It's rather bracketing your beliefs and judgments about the world, the kind of biases you might have about the world. So our common sense attitude towards the world, what he called the natural attitude, was what he wanted to bracket. He wanted to push aside our ordinary beliefs that we just simply take for granted, that the world is out there the way it is. And he wanted to ask, well, how precisely does it appear in consciousness?
Right.
Without having those beliefs and judgments get in the way.
So let me see if I got this. I'm looking at the cup. I'm looking at this very nice coffee cup from which I just drank this very nice coffee. And I assume there's a cup out there that I'm drinking from, right? And are you saying I should try and describe my experience like as if it were an hallucination or something? I mean, that's what it sounds like. I suspend my belief that there's an actual cup out there and describe my experience without using that assumption. Am I getting this kind of right or not?
Yeah, because he didn't want to do something like metaphysics. He didn't want to ask those kind of metaphysical questions about whether the cup is real or not real. Don't assume it's an illusion, but don't assume it's a perception. We don't know, you know, what we're bracketing are all those theories of how it is that we do experience. And we're just trying to get to the pure description of what it's like, what it feels like, what kind of other things might be involved when I taste the coffee. Maybe memories come back to me, or maybe it does spark my imagination or something like that.
So trying to get at a pure description of what it's like, bracketing the world, that means suspending various beliefs and assumptions. Now, I want to, when we come back after a break, I'm going to ask you, why the devil should I do that? What do I gain by doing that? So I want you to think about that in the interim, okay? You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about consciousness and lived experience with Sean Gallagher, author of How the Body Shapes the World. And we'll talk more about this when Philosophy Talk continues.
Have you ever been experienced? Well,
Now, we all know about the Jimi Hendrix experience, but what is it really like to experience Jimi's music? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything except your intelligence. My colleague John Perry is away today, but I'm here with our guests thinking about phenomenology and lived experience. Our guest is Sean Gallagher from the University of Memphis, author of How the Body Shapes the Mind. So, Sean, I get this idea, I think, of bracketing the world. I get that it brings consciousness kind of to the fore. Not pure consciousness, like not because it's still consciousness of something, but it brings consciousness to the fore. What's the benefit of doing that?
That's right. So we have what Husserl and a long tradition before him termed intentionality, that consciousness is always consciousness of something. And what he's trying to get to is a description of what that is. What's motivating him, for example, Husserl, what was motivating him was, in fact, a concern for science. Edmund Husserl's work is thought to be anti-science, but in fact it's not. He didn't want to do the empirical science, but he, like many philosophers before him, Descartes, Kant, they were very concerned about what they called the foundations of science. And, of course, one way to think about that is to think that as a scientist, we work consciously. Our access to the world is through consciousness. We only can do science by being conscious of things around us and observing and doing experiments and so forth. But it all comes back to consciousness. So Husserl's concern was, well, what about consciousness? What if consciousness actually distorts our perception of the world? Or, consciousness is something like a window that we're looking through. What if that window is dirty or somehow rather wobbly or distorted? So how can we make sure that we're getting a good grasp of what the world is,
so is this,
when we do science?
Is it the idea then to, I'm going to use a word, I'm not quite sure it's the right word, is the idea to problematize consciousness, to ask, well, what is it? How reliable is it? And make it an object of study with the idea of understanding better how it works and what it contributes to our overall understanding of or takes away? Or, I mean, is that the idea?
Yes, I think in part that's part of it. And one could do that scientifically. One can study consciousness scientifically, of course. But then you're already presuming, because you're using consciousness when you're doing your science, you're already presuming in some way this access that we have.
Well, right. But that's what I was going to ask you. That sounds, you say Husserl was interested in a science, right? But science thinks of itself as what Nagel called it, occupying the view from nowhere. I don't think that's quite right, but I think it's this third personal point of view. Like from the outside, I study the cup, not, by taking an objective point of view toward it, asking what in the world, how does it arise out of the quantum, all that sort of stuff. My conscious experience of the cup is from the first person point of view, right? It's I seeing the cup. It's subjectivity meeting the object. But if you're going to one might think that if one's going to study subjectivity and consciousness itself scientifically, you should take a third-person point of view toward it, which seems the very opposite of what the phenomenologist does. So what about that?
Yeah, well, I think part of what phenomenology does is it tells us that we have to be really careful about that third-person perspective, especially if what we're studying is consciousness itself, which operates from a first-person perspective. So if you try to, in some way, explain consciousness by way of third-person processes, so, for example, things going on in the brain, the question is, are you going to get all of the aspects that seemingly are part of experience and what you're experiencing? So that's part of the problem, I think. And the concern for doing science, you might think of it this way. So if you were wanting to do something like neuroscience, if you're trying to understand how the brain works and how it does what it does, and in some way how it gives us experience, then it would be good to have a really good description of what it is that you're trying to study using your neuroscientific methods. And in many cases, in many experiments, what you're trying to study is the experience that the subject is having, or their behavior in some way. Yeah. And so if you have a real, if you start with a good description of, well, is this going to be something like memory, or is it going to be something more like imagination, or is this a test of perception, you know, and then exactly what do we mean by perception, and getting at those types of issues are precisely what phenomenology is trying to do.
Yeah, I get you. I get you. I'm going to ask you one puzzle, then I'm going to go to a color, though, because when I try and do science, like the science of color, say, I don't use a phenomenological description of color. I mean, the color is present to me in a certain way. There's something it's like to see red. There's something it's like to see pain. But when I talk about what that is in the physical world, I talk about reflectance patterns of light. I talk about frequencies and all that, and ratios of frequency and stuff like that, which doesn't mention the subject. It's not from the subjective point of view. I mean, does that mean that the I just wonder about this phenomenological scientific characterization of consciousness, whether it's consistent with some of the other ways we think of consciousness, science, which involves leaving the subjectivity behind, that factoring out the subjectivity.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of different meanings to the concept of subjectivity. So one meaning is to take a subjective perspective on something in the sense that it's biased or prejudiced. And that, of course, is something that science is trying to eliminate or get beyond. But another sense of subjectivity is something there having to do with your experience, that even the scientist has experiences, and that kind of subjectivity doesn't simply disappear. One tries to use methods, but that doesn't guarantee the complete absence of the experiential aspect of what we're doing. So subjectivity, if part of what we're trying to study is subjectivity, we can understand that from perhaps a third-person perspective, but that might not get us the full picture. So the idea is to put phenomenology and science together,
yeah,
and to come at this from different perspectives and try to get a fuller picture.
Right. That's really cool. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the phenomenology of lived experience with Sean Gallagher. And Dinah from Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dinah.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for having me. So speaking to the topic of experience and consciousness, I wanted to comment regarding the roving philosophical reporters example with a man with post-traumatic stress.
Okay.
And then also referencing consciousness and the awareness. And I think one thing that's really important to note as someone who's gone through that experience of post-traumatic stress and in some way consciously and in some way completely at effect of my neurology, it's really important to stress that with that example, people have like a button that gets pushed and before they know it, their nervous system is going into reaction mode. And that I just wanted to add that as a responsible comment to that particular topic. With
right.
trauma, there's such a neurological component that dominates over anything related to consciousness or even psychology.
Yeah, Dinah, thanks for that. That's a really good point. I'm going to try and press you on this kind of point, Sean, a little bit. So Husserl and the phenomenologists wanting to bring consciousness to the fore, I don't know if they presumed that consciousness and the essence of consciousness was manifest, could be manifest, made manifest to itself that way. But, you know, if you're a kind of a Freudian, a kind of certain kind of cognitive science, you think all the action is kind of below consciousness. Consciousness is a generated thing, and consciousness doesn't understand its own self-generation. So going back to Dinah's experience, stuff happening in the brain complicated stuff happening in the brain bubbles up into consciousness, and consciousness takes it as a given, but it's really a complicated phenomena of which we're only seeing the iceberg. The tip of the iceberg. What do the people in the phenomenological tradition think about that?
Yeah, so I agree with much of that. And actually, the last chapter of my book, How the Body Shapes the Mind, is called Before You Know It. And it's a way, the idea of the phenomenologist is not that phenomenology is going to explain absolutely everything, but that, in fact, there are some things happening, shaping our consciousness that are happening below the surface, so to speak, of consciousness, bodily aspects, neurological aspects, emotional aspects that we might not be aware of. And all of those filter into and start to structure and shape what our conscious experience might be like. So phenomenology may not be able to get to those types of processes, and that's why you need science and other kinds of studies to give us a better idea of the broader picture.
So, that makes me think, though, then that I'm not sure. I'm no Husserl scholar. I'm no Merleau-Ponty scholar. That makes me think, though, that actually the phenomenological perspective and the technique of bracketing the world along that may bring consciousness to the fore in some sense and turn it into an object of study. But the phenomenological technique doesn't necessarily have the tools to reveal to consciousness its own essence, right? That you may need computer modeling, neural science, all this stuff, so that we're back to the third-person point of view may have the ultimate say here about the nature of consciousness. I know you don't want to go that way, but why not?
Yeah, because still, you don't get the whole... It's about getting the whole picture, I think. And so with a third-person perspective, you get very good explanations of... perhaps how the brain might contribute to what's going on, but not just the brain, other kinds of processes that include embodiment and the environment and all kinds of things happening in the environment that might involve other people. Well, this is a very big perspective yeah. that one needs to get the picture. Science gives us one aspect or some aspects of that picture, but not the whole thing. Phenomenology, I think, can fill in some of the important information that we need.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the phenomenology of lived experience. And Rachel from Gulfport, Florida is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk all the way from Gulfport, Florida.
Hi, Rachel. This is fascinating. It's the first time I've heard your program. And I hope that this is a contribution. I hope I didn't take you too literally. At the beginning, you asked if anyone, what it was like to experience the Jimi Hendrix experience. And I did, twice.
Okay, and what do you want to tell us about it, Rachel?
It was beautiful, absolutely. All-encompassing experience of absorbing the music and being inspired by it and connecting with the musicians and the sounds. I mean, it was a true mind blower. It was before I had ever experimented with drugs or anything else. I was 15 and 16 at the times I saw him. So I just wanted to say it was quite lovely.
Well, thanks for that input, and thanks for calling all the way from Gulfport, Florida. Sean, I want to ask you something about phenomenology. I said, a book could never, instruction or abstract philosophical thought could never teach you what lived experience teaches you, that consciousness discloses the world in a way that nothing else can. Is that a right way to think of? I'm not sure if Husserl and Heidegger and all that would agree with that or not. Would they or would they not?
I think that's exactly right. You can study and learn from a book and also a third person perspective, and you don't necessarily get the experiential aspect of it. So Husserl talked about what he called the life world. It's a concept in his philosophy. And Heidegger talked about being in the world.
Right.
And definitely, for example, being on a radio program like this, I'm I'm actually in New Orleans rather than out there in California with you, so we're not face-to-face. I don't see your facial expressions. I don't see your gestures. So I don't have a full sense of you know, how we're doing here. But I hear your voice, and I can understand intellectually, for example, how you know, the line of thought that we're trying to pursue. So there's a difference. If I were there with you and encountering you as another person, yeah, as a second person, that would be a very different experience,
right,
than this kind of long-distance communication.
Which strikes me, here's another thing that strikes me about phenomenology that's deep. Maybe I'm just mistaking something, but it strikes me as a really deep point. Experience, as the folks like to say, discloses the world to us. But experience is also, I said it was in the mind, but that's kind of true, but it's part of the world. So somehow experience discloses the world of which it's part, and then it discloses the world of which it's part from where it's located or situated in the world, which is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Merleau-Ponty's philosophy is very relevant to this, because he was the phenomenologist who emphasized embodiment. And much of embodied cognition these days in contemporary thought stems from some of his work in phenomenology. For him, the body is sort of double-sided in the sense that it's the body that I live, the what he called the lived body, the body that I experience, that I feel pain in and things like that. But it's also the objective body, the body I can see as part of the world. It's a material thing as well.
Yeah.
And this ambiguity between these two sides, so to speak, is an important aspect of what needs to be explored.
Well, I want to explore that with you some more in our final segment after we take some callers and do some business. But I want to explore that because that part puzzles me. And I wonder, it seems to me quite different from Husserl as I understand Husserl. But we'll take that up in our next segment. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking about phenomenology and lived experience with Sean Gallagher, author of How the Body Shapes the Mind. How can phenomenology, which focuses on the first-person experience, contribute to a scientific understanding of ourselves? How can embodiment give us greater access to the world? Body, self, and science, when Philosophy Talk continues. Phenomena. Phenomena, doo-doo-doo-doo. Who knew the Muppets had a thing for phenomenology? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything except your intelligence. My colleague John Perry is away today, but our guest, Sean Gallagher from the University of Memphis, is with us, and we're talking about the phenomenology of lived experience. And we've got a caller on the line with a great name, Ken. I'm not sure where you're from, Ken, but welcome to Philosophy Talk. What's your comment or question?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was concerned with in reading the person's story about going through the war, that the thing that's translated is something like soul. So if you take the mind out of the experience equation, what is the effect of the experience on the soul?
The soul. I don't know that the phenomenologists have a notion of soul. Do they, Sean?
They don't speak too often about the soul, but they acknowledge that the mind is more than just the cognitive and conscious aspect. And it's of course, it's more difficult to do a phenomenology, I think, of the soul and what that might mean.
Yeah.
But they definitely look at the world that we are in and try to talk as deeply as they can about all of these issues.
So I want to focus a little bit on what I understand to be, maybe I'm wrong, again, I'm no scholar of this, what I understand to be two rather different approaches to phenomenology, which sometimes make me wonder what's in common between these different approaches. So on the one hand, there's Husserl, who I think is a kind of souped-up Cartesian guy, right? Because he's bracketing the world and all that. I know he believed there was a body, and I don't think he was like an idealist or anything, but this bracketing the world, You know, that's one thing. But this, what we were talking about before, is a kind of phenomenology that believes that the world that the consciousness and experience disclose to us is a world in which experience and consciousness is situated, partly by means of the body being situated in the world. And I know this example from, I think it's Merleau-Ponty, where a blind man's navigating the world with a cane, right? The cane, in some ways, it's part of the world, but it's also part of his consciousness because it like extends his perceptual apparatus out into the world. He kind of navigates the world by using this thing that's in the world, but it's also tied to his perception. He can't see the world kind of with his eyes, but he kind of sees it in some sense with the cane. So it makes like perception and the world like, you know, one thing. That seems very un-Husserl-like to me. Am I getting the, is that wrong, that that's un-Husserl-like or what?
I think it's not un-Husserl-like. So Merleau-Ponty learned quite a bit from reading Husserl, and he actually, during the war, went to Belgium to read some of the unpublished transcripts there. And one of those was a book called Ideas, Volume 2, where Husserl talks quite a bit about the body and about the lived body and how we experience the body and how that can shape our experience of the world. So Merleau-Ponty picks up a lot from Husserl. So it's not so alien to Husserl, I think. But Merleau-Ponty definitely develops it further. He takes that example of the blind man's cane from a neurologist, Henry Head, who talked about it. And it is, from a phenomenological perspective, it is something like an extension of the body, what he called the body schema, which gave us sort of the world at the end of the cane was experienced as if it was part of one's own body. So it was an extension of the body schema, he would say.
But the body is not, it's just, is it just an extension of, what I was wondering, if it's, is it just an extension of the body? I can understand like prosthetic devices extending my body and tools extending my body. But it seems like if the blind man is navigating the world by means of this thing, it's not just an extension of the body, it's an extension of his perceptual apparatus, which is part of his mind, so it's an extension of his consciousness. Or is that too spooky to think about?
No, because, I mean, Merleau-Ponty is thinking of the body really in terms of the embodied mind. It's the body as the way that we are in the world, the way that we are connected or coupled to the world. And perception comes through the body, and that's something that you can't get around. So there are, in fact, scientific experiments these days to show that tool use, for example, can extend peripersonal space. So that's the reachable space around us.
Yeah.
We get a sense, we get an experience of our space expanding if we are using a tool,
so,
something like
okay,
a cane.
So one thought, one more thought. You're thinking, making me think all kinds of thoughts here. One thought. So, this Husserl bracketing the world can sound kind of Cartesian. Descartes retreats to his study, right, goes into this kind of doubting everything and all this stuff, and wondering if he has a body, if there's a world, if there's a mathematical reality out there. But this, what you're telling me about phenomenology, makes it sound very, very anti-Cartesian, right? Because the divide between consciousness and the world seems like a kind of a false divide, if this is right. Is
that
right?
Yeah. Merleau-Ponty was definitely anti-Cartesian. He was disagreeing very strongly with Descartes in the same way that Gilbert Ryle
Right. But what about Husserl? Was Husserl So I kind of hear Husserl as Cartesian and Merleau-Ponty as rejecting the kind of Cartesian elements of, is that right or wrong?
So Husserl takes Descartes as one starting point, and he sort of walks his way through the beginnings of Descartes' Meditations. But when Descartes suddenly has to appeal to logic and the existence of God in order to prove that there is a world, Husserl says, look, the world is already there, available to us in consciousness.
Right.
It's the intentionality that we don't need to follow Descartes. we can pick up on the intentionality and do phenomenology.
Okay, we got an email. So we had a phone call from my namesake. That was Ken from somewhere. And we got an email from John's namesake. John in Berkeley says, there seems to be in Husserl a process by which all the different pieces of bracketed consciousness get sewed together. How does this happen?
Yeah, so...
That's a very profound question.
Yeah, some of your comments and some of the listeners commented on listening to music. By the way, I like the choice of your music, Jimi Hendrix and the Muppets. Yeah. It's great. One of Husserl's favorite examples was how we are able to listen to a melody. Because, on one view, we might just be hearing whatever the note is that's being sounded just now. But somehow or other, if that were the case, we would not be able to hear a melody per se, because a melody is made up of many notes. So the question is, how does consciousness tie these notes together in such a way that we can actually hear a melody? So he has this kind of very deep analysis of what he calls time consciousness that knits together the different contents that we're experiencing in consciousness, depending upon kind of an immediate reaching back, which he called retention, and an immediate anticipatory aspect, which he called protension.
Does he have, those are fancy technical terms.
Yes.
Does he have, I'm going to bring in a little Kant here, and maybe a little John Perry. I mean, Kant had this idea of the transcendental subject, the I think that's present throughout, that must, all my experience must be the experiences of a single I think. This I think has a time consciousness, has a spatial consciousness, but the I think belongs to them all. So there's an I. It's not a Cartesian kind of mysterious subject, but it's this knitting together function of the kind of transcendental ego. Time consciousness is fine, but only if there's something that unifies the time into a single field. So does Husserl have anything like Kant's transcendental ego going?
Yeah, so this is a really good question. He does have something which he refers to as the transcendental ego, and he has a lot to say about it, and it's not always the same thing, let's say. But what he does say is that the transcendental ego is itself constituted within the temporal flow of consciousness. So this knitting together of time consciousness that we just mentioned before is actually more basic than the ego.
Yeah.
So he was combining the empiricist's notion of, something like the stream of consciousness. He read William James, for example. And trying to think about, what the formal ego or transcendental ego is within the real history of the individual subject as they experience the world.
Well, this is heady stuff. This is heady stuff, Sean, and we could talk about it more and more. But I was going to get a caller in here. Brian from San Francisco would probably be our last caller. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Brian.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Wow. A way that I've been simplifying this kind of stuff and understanding it for myself is that of thinking consciousness is a thing we're swimming in. It's outside the head. It's not, we think of consciousness as being inside in our brains and all this kind of stuff, but rather we are picking up on total consciousness through our own, like radio, like we are our own radio signals tuned into what, we're interested in, like an insect is going to be interested in picking up the consciousness that applies to it and so on. And so that, and we live through our personal experience that makes sense to us, but consciousness is a thing that's outside and we're swimming in it.
Yeah, let's see what John thinks about that metaphor. Consciousness is the water in which we're swimming. It's not inside of us. What do you think about that, John?
I actually like the metaphor. It's definitely we're swimming in this flow of consciousness. The idea that it's outside versus inside, that's actually something that Husserl, Merleau-Ponty, the phenomenological tradition, and tried to get beyond, thinking about something inside the head versus something outside the head. Rather, if you could bracket, let's say, those concepts of internal versus external,
right?
And just describe your experience. It's not real clear you know, where.
Right, because this goes back to the thing where consciousness is what discloses the world to you, and it's also part of the world. So it's not something like outside the world. Do you agree with that? I'll give you the last word.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. And we find all kinds of fascinating things and experiences of the world within our consciousness. Although within, you know, is not exactly the right way to put it.
Yeah, I know. But you know what, John? This has been a great conversation. I'm sorry John's been ill and not been able to be with us, but I thank you for joining me, okay?
I hope John feels better, and it was great. Thank you very much.
Our guest has been Sean Gallagher, professor of philosophy at the University of Memphis, author of How the Body Shapes the Mind. Now, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner and our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, get this, cogito ergo blago. I think, therefore I blog. You can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org. Now, what's it like to talk this fast? Let's hear it from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, phenomenology, as I understand it, which is what phenomenology is all about, really, as I understand it, is a relatively recent addition to philosophy. Weary of studying history and the origins of the soul, philosophy turned to the study of what it means to walk across a room. It is ripe with questions. Is there a world to be perceived? Do we make the world with our perceptions? Is it just virtual goblins summoned hither by intentionality, whatever hither might mean? The familiar objects around us have a history which we take for granted, phenomenologically speaking, or ignore, unless it interferes with or influences our subjective reality, like a sticky car door we keep forgetting to fix, or the irritating coworker we have to arrange strategies to avoid. I'm not sure phenomenology has been good for philosophy. We now have weird concepts like false consciousness, or what the alt-right call fake news on the fake news sites they prefer. We keep calling into question the evidence of our own eyes because the evidence is tainted by mental issues, political beefs, denial, indifference, all sorts of things. One of the reasons we're always grumbling about nobody talking about the elephant in the room is we have trouble agreeing these days what a room is, even as we walk across it and around the elephant from which we avert our eyes. Plus, because of the internet, everybody knows everything now, especially men. This has led to a phenomenon called mansplaining, in which a man courts a person to tell him or her how fusion works or what we need to do in Syria or why we should still blame Hillary. This concept was introduced by the writer Rebecca Solnit, describing a party she was at in which a man was trying to explain a recent book about the early photographer Edward Muybridge, not paying attention to the fact that she had written it. Turns out, of course, he hadn't even read it, just read a review in the New York Review of Books, which is where, full disclosure, I get a good 80% of any cultural baggage I carry around. Mansplaining is a phenomenon once used to deliver exposition in cheesy science fiction movies. You see, Madge, when the gravity spills over into the atomic zone, an excess of zirconium Z5 mutates the insects into hideous dinosaur hybrids. We don't have those movies anymore, so the urge to explain is left to wander the earth, drifting, popping up at parties, bookstore aisles, cafes. And phenomenology has other impediments. We don't have zombies, but we have zombie movies. What do we do with this information? And we wonder, what is reality that we should perceive it? There have been calls for President Trump to release his tax returns. Well, a story in the Wall Street Journal from December 2016 might indicate why he's had trouble. It traces the ownership of a helicopter he owns in Scotland, which it turns out he doesn't own. He owns a revocable trust that owns 99% of a Delaware limited liability company that owns 99% of another Delaware LLC that owns a Scottish company that owns another Scottish limited company that owns a helicopter, which has a big red Trump on its fuselage. At least half the revenue Trump reported in a financial disclosure form came from 96 different LLCs. Phenomenology is all about the aboutness of things. So what is this new capitalism all about? Is a helicopter an asset or a means of transportation or both? Is who owns it just another series of what's? Whose reality is it, anyway? That's why we have lawyers, I guess. Phenomenologically, they say a picture of a pipe is not a pipe, and a map is not a country. Well, maybe now it is. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2017.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
Our senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Audrey Dilling, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Talk to the bomb.
But I have been talking to it, sir. And Pinback's talking to it right now.
No, no, Doolittle. You talk to it. Teach it phenomenology, Doolittle.
Sir?
Phenomenology.